following program is a radio documentary entitled Hope. It is a collection of interviews and music providing an insight into what the Hope Collective was and how it affected those involved in independent music. The program features interviews with Niall and Miriam McGurk from the Hope Collective, Andrew Bush, who played in the Waltons and now plays in Estelle and owns Murder City Records, Boz, who played in Onion Bread and now plays in the Steam Pig and writes Nosebleed Fanzine, Clodagh, who was a part of the Hope, Kids and GZ Collective and now plays in Espamassa, Niall Byrne, who played in Jack Beast and Flexihead and now plays in the Redneck Manifesto, and Dylan of the Bassy Youth Collective. First of all, could you introduce yourselves?
Okay, well, I'm Niall McGurk.
Miriam McGurk.
How did Hope Promotions come together?
It kind of evolved. It didn't, there was no grand plan or whatever, it just kind of evolved. Started off, I was playing in a band and we're ready to do a gig now, and so it was like, oh yeah, okay, well, we'll just find out where other bands play or go to the places where we've seen other bands play and ask, can we play there? And then from that kind of realised, oh yeah, it's not too hard to put a gig on. And then played a few gigs in that band and then started thinking maybe it'd be nice for bands that we like to come over to Ireland and play rather than having to travel over to the UK or wherever to see them. And so that happened, and there was still no name, there was still no Hope Promotions. It was just like, oh yeah, you know, the Membranes, we get the Membranes to come over to Ireland and play. So that happened, and then there was specifically a band called the Membranes, and they gave the phone number to all their friends who were in bands, and so more and more people started ringing up to say, oh yeah, could we come over? I had an idea then to actually put a name on the poster, because a lot of bands wouldn't have been very well known. So the idea was to put a name on the poster, and that maybe people who had been to a previous gig that they thought was good would go to the next one, because it was the same people putting the gig on. And that's kind of how Hope came about.
What was the core ideologies that Hope held?
Again, because it kind of evolved, the ideology kind of just evolved. It was just putting on gigs independently and at affordable prices, that people could afford to go to a gig and wouldn't be priced out of their price range, and we weren't thinking about money.
It was also bands that were specifically you wanted to see as well, though, rather than just any putting on any band. It would be like,
yes, certainly, yeah. But then bands were asking to come over, and so it was said, you know, they were told, right, there was no contract. I didn't want to deal with a band on a business level. It was all like, you know, there's no contracts involved, and everything was upfront financially. Like, this is how much the venue will cost, and whatever's left you can have. And then it kind of came about that we'd say, well, this is how much the venue cost. Some of the other bands could maybe get some money. You can have the rest, or you can give us some money as well to go to the next gig. But really, the core ideology was just like putting on gigs to try and make them accessible for everybody. We did try at one stage to have them, you know, with no age restrictions, and try and have as many all ages gigs as possible.
Can you tell me about some of the other projects Hope funded or did?
Brought out a record, a 12 inch with four bands on it, Kunis, In Motion, Wheel and Mexican Pets. The record was called A Statement is a Weapon in an Empty Hand. And the idea was initially to bring out a number of records, but one was enough. Personally, just was a bit more work than I was expecting. And we had some money. Fugazi played, I think, the second time they played in Dublin, and there was a lot of money left out after the gig. And so Fugazi kind of says, oh, we'll take this amount and you take a bigger amount. And so from that then, we were able to put on other gigs and not worry too much. Like, if a band came over, or if a band wanted to come over, I could say to them, how much is your fare? Well, we can cover that, because we have this fund here. And then there was a few fanzines around at the time. Just kind of got talking to people who are doing fanzines, and says, all right, we could give you a loan to bring out your fanzine. And if you can pay it back, you can pay it back. If you can't, no worries, because you got your fanzine out. So we kind of helped, I wouldn't say fund, but helped some fanzines come out with money. You know, we did some benefits as well. So a book which was called Document the Story of Hope, which went through every gig that we did and tried to get a recipe for every gig, make it a vegan recipe, and tell a little story about each gig. So that was funded with, I think, well, actually wasn't funded with much money. It was my man's money, more so than any money from Hope there was. But I think from the Hope Collective there might have been a small amount, I don't know, maybe €100 or something like that. But, you know, out of 2,500. But it's still, you know, there was some money going into it.
We always managed to stabilise it. Like, we never went into debt. We always kind of managed to just about have a little bit of money, enough to do the next gig, but there was never loads. The odd time, if we did a big gig, but then it would just go into the next gig. Because you'd inevitably lose money on gigs, like a smaller gig should cost more.
Yeah. And because we had the money there, you could go to a band who travelled over from the UK and say, well, how much did it cost on the ferry? And you could generally meet their travel costs. And if it meant that we didn't have enough money on the night, it didn't matter because there was a kind of a little fund on there. But also, it just Hope kind of helped fund React, which was the newsletter that I did. It was a free, initially it was out every month. It was just like an A4 sheet of paper, and then sometimes it was bigger and sometimes it was, I think it got to about 5,000 copies at one stage, but money went into that as well to help pay for the printing of it.
Hope organised 2 DIY festivals in the City Arts Centre in Dublin. Can you tell me about these?
A woman, Alison Rogers, worked in the City Arts Centre. I knew her from a friend of mine called Michael Murphy, and we were just talking one day about the City Arts Centre, and I was saying, that's like, you know, it's a waste of space because it's a very good space and we don't do anything. And I had to do a talk. She was running a class, something to do with music business or something. She asked me to give a talk about independent music. So I went in and spoke, and then I said to her, like, why don't we try and do something with this space and this idea of independent music and promoting it in Dublin? So she said, okay. And she got the venue. We didn't have to pay for a rental of the venue, and I think she may have got the PA and sound engineer as well, and said, okay, you go and pick the bands, but we want to pick the bands one night, which was, I think, the Friday night. So it was Friday night, Saturday all day, and a Sunday. So we decided then to, this was Hope, the Hope Collective, and we were meeting every week. So we'd meet every week and talk about all this stuff and, you know, decide whether agree, and we agreed to get involved with the City Arts Centre with these DIY festivals. So then we had to agree what bands we'd ask, both bands from Ireland and the UK. And we decided to get Sean from Rugger Bugger Records, Sean Forbes. He used to play with Watt Tyler, but he put out a lot of records, and he helped bring out Statement because it was pressed in the UK by Making. So got Sean over to talk. The idea was to have talks and stalls at the gig so that people could go along.
Workshops.
So Sean did a workshop on how to bring out your own record. And he brought over this piece of paper with like 12 or 13 steps and the phone number of a place in the Czech Republic. And a lot of people have since used that place. And then there was other workshops on general stuff like how to, at this stage I'm trying to remember, how to publish a fanzine, and there's one about being in a band, and another about rehearsing, and another one I think might have been about how to get a gig. And then there was, we asked people who had distros at the time to come along and sell stuff as well, and we kind of made some food and gave out food. But again, the idea was to promote this idea that people are doing things separate from mainstream music business, and to try and put forward that it's okay to do that. And it works, and it's probably better for some people to do it that way.
Do you feel the document book has helped introduce the ideas and story of Hope Promotions to a new generation?
I don't know if it's brought in any ideas. I don't know. You'd have to ask the new generation that. I'm not sure. To me, it tells a story of what happened at a certain time.
To me, it seems to have a bit anyway, because I mean, there was the whole, anybody who was involved at the time or who went to gigs at the time were interested in the book. And then from whenever Hope finished, or whatever went on from then, certainly carried on a little bit of what went on in Hope. And I think those people would still be interested in it and would be interested to read. I think, and I mean, you know, there has been feedback from people who really wouldn't have been around at the time and enjoyed it, reading the book and got something out of it. Maybe, and I won't admit it, but or even think it, but might have been a little bit inspired to do what they're doing now, maybe. I don't know, but maybe it's a bit much to think that. But I think what's happening now reflects a bit of what Hope was, so some of what's happening.
The document book has recently been published in America under the name Please Feed Me. How did this come together?
I printed up 500 copies of the book and thought I'd have about 200 under my bed. Not being able to sell.
Like Statement.
Like the Statement, because that didn't sell too well. But then after 3 weeks, they'd all gone, so I had to get another 500 printed up. And a couple of people in America people involved with bands that were in the book, like I suppose basically mainly like Fugazi, looked to sell the book in the States as document. So I sent over, I think about 150 to three different distros, AK Press and Last Gasp Discord in America. And they sold pretty quickly. And then I had to get another 500 printed up. And they went, and Last Gasp, an independent book distributor based in San Francisco, asked for another 150. And I was like, oh, well, I've none left. So I ordered more, and they didn't come out well. And I just went, right, I don't want to do any more. I've done enough. But Last Gasp had sent a book to Soft Skull Press, who are based in New York. They're friends of theirs. And they contacted me and asked, could I bring it out in the States? And I said no, because I didn't really want to. I hadn't even explored that idea. The idea was to bring out the book, publish it here, and try and get it out there to people, really in Ireland and maybe the UK as well. But then they wrote back to me and said, we don't want to exploit this story, and we don't want to, you know, make a fortune out of this or rip anybody off out of it. They did our sales talk, I suppose, basically. They thought it was a story that, you know, some people in the States might relate to, and that they felt it would be nice if people in the States had a chance to read it. I had a bit of emails to and fro, and then says, yeah, okay, sounds like it could happen. And then they asked, could I change the name of it from Document to Please Feed Me? And I kind of went, sounds a bit, you know, silly really. But there was a book out called Please Kill Me, which is about the New York punk scene. And they were kind of saying, oh, you know, if you have this kind of Please Feed Me, there's a link there. There's a link to punk scenes, a link to stories about stuff. And I was kind of, okay. And they also said that the word Hope, and Hope, you know, Promotions or Hope Collective, wouldn't mean anything to most of the people in communities in the States. Whereas maybe in Ireland, they might have, you know, if somebody was involved in punk or whatever, might go, oh yeah, I hope are the people who put on gigs in Dublin. Didn't really get as far as, you know, a place in the States. So I said, okay, I agree to it. And then they wanted to lay it out their own way. And I was going, oh no. But I laid out the first book. I did it all myself. I didn't know anything about graphic design. So I kind of was interested to see what they'd come up with. So they redesigned it. And
didn't change too much though.
No.
No compromising really having to be done.
Yeah, they didn't change any of the words, which was the main thing. And they didn't ask it and didn't look to it. And if they had have wanted to, well, it wouldn't have happened. They did make some mistakes, but I made some mistakes in the initial copy anyway. Yeah, I'm happy enough with the way it's kind of come out.
The biggest gig Hope did was a benefit in the SFX. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, Fugazi from America, Chumbawamba from England, and In Motion from Dublin played in the SFX. Fugazi were touring Europe, I don't know, I think it was their fourth time maybe their fifth time, and they asked, could I, you know, play Dublin? And we of course said yes, because we put them on the previous four times. We knew they were going to get a big crowd, so we thought about, okay, we'll try and maybe do something a bit different, and also maybe try and raise awareness and some money for ACT UP. And at the time, ACT UP were quite involved in, you know, promote AIDS awareness, so we thought it'd be nice to help that organization. And then we just had to try and pick a venue, so we went, the SFX was a decent venue, big time promoter in Dublin obviously seemed to use the SFX, so we said, oh, it'd be nice if we could have a gig in the SFX, and it didn't cost as much money, but yet we could still make a fortune out. So we kind of decided that the world was our oyster really, you know, and okay, Fugazi were going to come over, and really they were going to get like a minimum of 1,000 people, so I was like, okay, where will we pick and who will we get to play with them? And at that stage, Chumbawamba were a band that we liked, and thought it'd be a nice event if they played it, because they were a little bit different, but they still were at that stage talking about lots of good things. So we asked them to come over and said that we could get them a gig in Trinity College during the previous day or something, and that was gone. Like, we were able to get some money from the Trinity College ENTS officer to pay for their travel, so their travel fee was covered by that. And so they said, yeah, it sounded like a good idea. So we got the SFX through the ENTS officer again in Trinity. I asked him to book it because I knew we wouldn't have got it. So he booked it, and it was down at some sort of Trinity party. And then the owners of the SFX saw, it was, the SFX is owned by Jesuits, and they saw that it was an ACT UP benefit, and the actual ticket for the gig gave out information, like AIDS awareness information and condoms and how to use a hypodermic needle. So the Jesuits weren't too happy with that, and MCD, the promoters who used the SFX, didn't seem to be too happy about Hope somebody else putting a gig on. Not necessarily Hope, they didn't really care about it. You know, Hope wouldn't mean nothing to them. But just somebody else putting a gig on, and that it wasn't their usual £12.50 in. So the Jesuits contacted us and said that the gig wasn't going to happen. They had to pull the plug. And we were like, oh no, what are we going to do? So we were trying to get other venues and couldn't. But the ENTS officer from Trinity College got this Trinity College solicitor to write a letter to the Jesuits saying this gig has been organised for so long and you can't just do this. And then the Jesuits said, okay, if you withdraw the ticket, we'll allow the gig to go ahead. So we did up an alternative ticket, went into the Jesuits and says, here's the alternative ticket. And they said, okay. But we didn't withdraw the other tickets, we just showed the Jesuits the alternative ticket. And
They were none the wiser.
So the gig happened to him. How it came about, it was just like, we knew Fugazi were going to get 1,000 people. Or, well, you don't know, and you can never be 100%.
Well, either Fugazi or Chumbawamba on their own would have got a great crowd. So together it was an amazing event.
Yeah.
It was like, we made up t-shirts and like posters were fantastic. And just the whole package, that kind of, we had a lot of people involved in it. It was a huge kind of undertaking from what we were used to doing. So we got friends involved who were artists and who really took it all very, very seriously, designing all these tickets and posters and t-shirts. It ended up looking really, really smart in the end. And I mean, the night itself was just incredible. We ended up...
I made about a thousand pounds.
We ended up having a lot of costs.
A lot of costs.
Because of everything that we put into it with regards to all the merchandise. It ended up costing a bit more, but... It was a great night.
It was great to see the SFX sold out. 1,200 people were there, and an American and a UK band and a Dublin band playing, and the sound was perfect. There was big displays, there was big like screens with stuff going on all the time. There was stalls everywhere and people selling stuff, and it was £4.50 in, and we still managed to make money. And the bands got paid their travel expenses. Well, Fugazi got paid their travel expenses. Chumbawamba made theirs from the gig in Trinity, and fed and everything, and everybody was treated fine. And to us, that in itself was a statement, because this was able to happen, and it was £4.50 in, and the following week, I don't know, Megadeth or someone would have been playing there for £12.50.
Is there any message you took from Hope and passed on to your children?
Well, I mean, they're still very young. Ellen is 5 and Robert is 3, but I suppose, I don't know, we've probably exposed them to stuff that maybe other children their age wouldn't be exposed to. But I mean, they've been to gigs and we're not afraid to bring them into that environment. Some people wouldn't want to, for whatever reason they go, and not often when they can. It's all ages gig. I suppose as they get older, it would come into play a bit more, where you would try and, I mean, initially when our, like the older daughter was very young, we'd make her listen to music that we liked, and she was really into it, and it was great. She's getting a bit older now, and she's kind of getting her own taste, which is very dodgy. We thought at first, oh god, she's going to be into really cool music, but she has her own personality, but and she uses her own music now. But I don't know, in the meantime it'll come into play a bit more.
Yeah, I think that what we did with Hope or whatever was just a reflection of what we do with our life. Without sounding too heavy, it was part of our life. And then, so as part of our life, you know, putting on a gig or bringing out a book or bringing out a record or a fanzine was done with a bit of, I don't know, with respect for people. And we're trying to bring up our children with respect for people.
I think we're pretty strong-minded in how we want to bring them up. Anyway, there's different dimensions to your personality. So, I mean, that's one part of it. Then, like the fact that we're both vegan and the children are, that's a big part of our, you know, it's something that's very important to us, and the whole animal rights, and maybe trying to get other people to know about being vegan and stuff like that. Like, all of that is very important to us, and that's certainly a big part of our lives now for them as well, which is kind of something that you choose for yourself. And when you have your own children, it's you have to give it a lot of thought. I think you're now thinking for other people too. There's so many different aspects of it that you kind of bring to them, and I mean, you've no idea how it's gonna go like in a few years, but I do think we would maybe try and make them aware of the bad sides of the music industry and the good sides of and how things can be done differently, and how they want to do fanzines or books or whatever they want to do, they can do. Because I don't think, you know, we would have had that, being exposed to that growing up. Now more so just found for himself, whereas you could kind of maybe show them that, you know, anything is possible, you know, and not to be afraid to do any of it. I may not be into any of it though.
What was your best and worst memories of Hope?
It's kind of hard to give a best memory, because for me, if you give a best memory, does that mean all the other ones weren't so good? It's hard to kind of, like, I do remember seeing Dawson in the attic and going, wow, this band are amazing. I remember seeing the X playing the Fox and Pheasant and thinking that was brilliant. Fugazi, I remember I had to go up onto the stage and do something in the SFX the night Fugazi were playing, and looking down at 1,200 people, that was pretty good as well. God, Yeah.
Probably cheesy, but I really feel like for me, it was definitely, you know, gigs that were memorable. But I mean, we just met so many people as well. And I think, you know, people that we've met and still are friends with now. And I think that was probably one of the best things, because for a long time, the whole thing was Niall on his own putting on gigs. And like, I was there, but he was the main kind of driving force of it all. And then we became a collective. It was great. Like, we'd meet up every week and then we'd all bring food, and that was brilliant because we just had a lot of fun. I mean, there was a lot of fighting and arguments and just disagreements, but that was part of it. But I just think, you know, we made so many friends, and they're still there now. Like, and that was just, I felt that was great, you know, that you'd still have that from it, because otherwise the rest of it's gone. That was probably a good part.
I think my worst memory would have been at a gig one night, and it would have been over some equipment at a gig or something like that, and one band didn't want to let another band use their equipment, and kind of turned on me for it. And it wasn't, these weren't touring bands, and turned on me and said that, like, you know, you should be sorting this all out. And I was like, you should be sorting it all out. You know, you talk to each other, you know, I don't have to do everything for you, but, you know, that's the way that band felt at the time. But to
that's
me,
it's such a bad worst memory.
No, I suppose it's
not. was hassling the new inn one night, which was pretty bad.
The toilets?
Yeah. Somebody ripped a sink off a toilet, off a wall. Got into a lot of trouble over that.
But again, focusing on kind of the worst or the best, then there's the whole load in between. That was what was important, you know. And then the meetings in the Hope Collective and all that, and talking to people and exchanging ideas and just exchanging views and all. It was great, and meeting people from bands all over the world and keeping in touch with them, like, it's all, it was good.
It was great, like, because Niall had this really, really grotty flat for a while, and like, you wouldn't put a dog into it, but some of the bands stayed there. What was the girl band? Babes in Thailand stayed there. I mean, you'd want to see it, like, to imagine now that they actually stay there, and there was no problem. You know, they didn't, I'm sure they hated it, but they never said. And, you know, like, to actually do that and get away with it is amazing, really, because, you know, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably some band's worst memories
of Ireland. Yeah. If you were to ask the band, they'd probably come up with that flat.
He can sign! He can sign! But he could find out! Why could stop crying? Oh, there's so many stars that we cover to it. She can't play, then you would understand what she was saying. Oh, there's so many stuff that we should get through this to our damn mind.
Hold your applause. Eddie Van Curren will sing you a few.
Have you ever heard of the experiment of Pavlov's dog? You ring a bell and the dog salivates. I just thought I'd mention that. What?
Cat calls, time for cat calls.
Tell us all to fuck off. Come
on. Sod off, thank you.
All right, thank you. I remember when I had my first beer. Okay.
He kept dreaming, other day they realized what he was feeling. Oh, there's so many songs that we sung with students, two lots and one cup. Only so many songs that we sung with students, two lots and one cup. Only so many songs can be sung with two lips, two lungs and one tongue. Only so many songs can be sung with two lips, two lungs and one tongue.
That was Two Lips, Two Lungs and One Tongue by Now Means Now, recorded live in the New Inn in 1990. Okay, first of all, could you introduce yourself?
My name is Bars.
Do you feel the name Hope represented the collective well?
I've no idea. To tell you the truth, it's not something I would have ever thought about. Hope was starting up. There was, it's kind of a pretty good indication, a pretty general indication of what they were setting out to try and achieve, or what Niall was setting out to try and achieve, which was, I guess, getting a lot of his favourite bands over here, Fugazi or whoever was kind of touring and missing out on Ireland or not realising that it existed, plus promoting the idea that there is something beyond what was popular at the time, which was a lot of kind of large, noisy bands. Slayer and Suicidal Tendencies and that sort of thing, which would have been kind of, you know, people's focal point around the late 90s. So I don't know if you're asking me whether it's a good name or not. I mean, all it is, it's just a four-letter word, so, and it's a polite four-letter word. I don't really know.
If Hope didn't happen, what do you think would have taken its place?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to think that. If you were, for instance, to look at the Hope book, document book, and look at all the gigs that were happening, it would be a mistake to think that that was the only thing that was going on in Dublin at the time. Now, what Hope did was make that escalate a lot. It did, like, make the activity sort of increase. I mean, there was a lot of that sort of thing happening anyway. Like, people organising gigs in, what, the Fox and Pheasant or the Grattan or whatever with four or five of their mates' bands. And, you know, that sort of thing is as good as anything, is promoting what's going on locally. But I think... on a more ambitious scale, the Hope thing was definitely very important. I think it's in a way that if you look at, you know, a lot of bands who were kind of touring and missing out here, say if you go back to Fugazi again, because that was kind of what was central to setting it up on. It seemed what was central to setting it up on a kind of more regular basis. It kind of made you realise that these people aren't like miles away or untouchable. They're people who can be dealt with directly. I think though that like stuff would have always, I mean, there's always been punk bands and bands doing stuff for themselves in Dublin. I know it was pretty rubbish during the 80s, but it was kind of, I think towards the end of the 80s, it was kind of gathering pace anyway, because there was a lot of, I think the interest in loud music was kind of perpetuating itself through people growing up. You know, if you look at the music that was around at the time, your kind of entry-level loud music, you know, you have stuff like, oh, you have like a lot of metal bands, but then you have stuff like the Pixies and Sonic Youth and, you know, everything that people were kind of discovering through their school friends or anything. So when you have that sort of a situation, you always have people who will go a rung further and maybe discover the bands that are on these people's thanks lists, or, you know the way it works. People tend to find out about a group of bands that are kind of accessible, and then they kind of go deeper and deeper into the underground and figure things out. I think Hope definitely helped get a lot of those bands over here, but a lot of them people would have known about anyway, you know.
Has Hope inspired you in any way?
Oh, very much so. I think that it gave an audience for bands. It gave like a, it was something people would sort of tend to go to those gigs. I don't know whether it was perceived as a mark of quality or just, it wouldn't be as depressing. It wouldn't be four people sitting in upstairs in a room in a pub watching somebody's mate's band playing on a Tuesday night. It was kind of a little bit more organised, so you got the impression that if you were going to go to something, you'd get to see like decent bands playing. I think, you know, when the sort of initial kind of period of activity or Hope, like in the late 80s or say early 90s, escalated, a lot of people latched onto that. A lot of people latch onto what's happening, and it is inspirational. It's inspirational to see that somebody's kind of overwhelmingly enthusiastic and all they're getting in return is a pain in the hole, you know. So I mean, who wouldn't find that inspirational?
What was your relationship like with the members of the Hope Collective?
I don't think we had much of a relationship with the Hope Collective. If you're talking in terms of Hope Promotions, like say up until about 1993-94, when I was playing with Onion Breath, that was just a case of every so often you know I went to as many of those gigs as I could, and every so often you'd be kind of paining at the door and Niall and Miriam would go, do you want to play this gig? And that was always great. It was always great to be offered something interesting, especially they put us on with the Spurnbirds, which was, you know, kind of wonderful. That was like one of the bands we had grown up with. I think things might have got a little bit shady after that once we put the Steam Pig together, because it was kind of like one of these kind of periods in Dublin where a lot of the venues had closed down, and then there was nothing for like the whole summer in 1994. There was nowhere to play, and even going into 95 when we started up, we had this situation where we were ringing up venues like the aesthetic, the fox and pheasant, which became Beans, and trying to put on gigs, trying to organise gigs, and people wouldn't do it for us. They'd go, no. And if we had been put on by somebody who was established, like a promoter like that, it wouldn't have been a problem. But I think there's this vision that, or this idea that people have in their heads that kind of, you know, a lot of the kind of bands that had a kind of more kind of hardcore punk sound all clumped off onto one side and decided to go on the offensive against the Hope Collective and what they were doing, which is complete nonsense. I mean, it might have been true in one or two people's minds, but that's an individual conflict and not down to the way it actually is. I mean, we the Steam Pig played Hope gigs. That's all I can really say about it. I mean, you know, I've always like had a lot of respect for the way, you know, the way that they continue to do things. I mean, not an awful lot of it interested me as time went on, but that's just down to personal taste.
You received a £30 loan from the Hope Collective to bring out your first issue of Nosebleed Fanzine. Do you think Nosebleed Fanzine would have happened without this?
Yeah, I got €30, which was the entire money for the print run at the time. There was this guy in England called Bob Print. I mean, I think he printed every fanzine for like 2 or 3 years. It was this kind of scruffy, semi-adequate, black, messy print on this recycled paper, and you'll kind of know if you see the type of fanzines there were. But I mean, I had tried to do one a couple of years beforehand, and it felt a bit, I was still in school and there was no way of financing it. I had, by the time I got around to starting up Nosebleed, I was on an ESF grant and I was in college, so I had money available to me anyway. But what happened was I got a lump sum of money at the beginning of a month. I didn't want to spend it all and not get enough back to pay my rent, so it would have happened anyway, but it just made it a lot easier for me. It kind of kick-started it.
What was your favourite Hope gig?
I'd say Alice Donut and Barnstormers, without a doubt. Fucking fantastic. Just trying to think what other ones were particularly memorable. I guess the first time I won the Fugazi gigs at McGonagall's, that was when they were kind of like a Margin Walker stage. They were still, you know, you were getting all the songs off the first two EPs, and it was pretty special because it was like really fresh and really new, and there was no other bands that sounded like that at the time. They're the ones that stick out. I mean, there's probably an awful lot of others. I would say, thinking back to everything they ever put on, Alice Donut would definitely be my favourite.
Was the independent music scene more unified back then or now?
I actually think things are better now. Wouldn't appear that way because people are probably spoiled. I mean, people have access to any band in the world they want via the internet, via MP3s or downloading music or whatever. You know, you can get information on any band you want by just finding the websites. So things are definitely better now. You know, if you talk about late 80s, early 90s or pre-internet, I mean, in many ways it's like the information dark ages. You know, you're relying on the information you're getting through fanzines or through hearsay from your mates or whatever. Conspiracy theories or false rumours get made up by people. So things are definitely better now. It's matured a little bit in that people are more comfortable with the idea. I mean, if you look at the amount of bands in Dublin or Ireland, not even just punk bands or whatever, or sort of underground music bands, I mean, there's a massive industry of people who are doing things for themselves. And throughout the 80s, you probably might have had 10 independent releases in Ireland. Up until about 95, you probably would have had about 15 or 20. By 1998, you probably had a couple of hundred coming out every year. And now it's just nuts. It's like, you know, people are releasing CDs every week. And I mean, it's catering to all sorts of tastes. So it's a good thing. A lot of it goes right back to the groundwork that was put there by Hope. It's not solely responsible for it. I think it would have happened anyway.
The following interview is with Andrew Bush. When did you first hear about Hope Promotions?
Well, we'd seen some gigs actually. So like bands like Wormholes and Jubilee and all that sort of hell on a lot of those bands before they broke big. And basically I went to see these gigs and you'd see the Hope logo and things, but I didn't really think anything of it until I started playing gigs in a band called The Waltons, which was 1996, I think. And that's when it sort of became a real thing to me, where I realised it was an organisation that put on bands like us.
What was your relationship like with the members of the Hope Collective?
I always thought it was fine. We never played a crazy amount of gigs for them, so the gigs we did play, we always got on fine with people like Noel. The only person I ever had any sort of hassle with was, I didn't really get on with Derek Byrne too well. I always thought he was a bit of a pompous freak. He was kind of one of those, you know, he meant well but managed to take the fun out of, I think, a lot of what they did, and maybe in a way that helped it collapse when it did, you know. But basically I always thought they were sound lads and girls, and some of them I've known, like Clodagh and stuff, I still know today and we still consider a friend today, so after nearly 10 years. So
how did you feel about the rivalry that existed between Hope and the more punk orientated promoters like FOAD?
It was fucking silly. It was, again, the band I was playing in at the time all that was really prevalent was I played in a band called The Waltons, and we kind of floated around between both scenes, so it didn't affect us that much, but there was a lot of pressure on other bands. There was the punk scene, and then Deco and all them would call the other scene like the hippie scene. So in that whole scene, the FOAD thing was set around the Chinaman, and you'd have like bands like Strychnine DC and Puget Sound, who played more obvious punk at the time, and then anything like us, we were sort of arty. But because we knew Puget Sound, we'd jump between. I know bands like the Steam Pig were just relegated to playing Chinaman gigs, even though they probably would have liked to maybe play Hope gigs, but they were just never asked. It was stupid, you know. When there'd be a DIY festival on, Deco would put on like a fuck Hope DIY festival sort of thing, and you know, it was kind of ridiculous and stupid.
Should they have worked together?
I think they would have got more done, because it would have made it a bigger thing instead of breaking it down. But that's sort of how punk works, basically. It's you have something where it should be a big group of people against this whole other thing, and then it just breaks down and down and down until you got 50 subgenres who don't want to mix with each other, and you end up with little scenes of 100 people when you could have a big scene of maybe 1,000 people. So yeah, I think if they had to work together, it would have been a better thing, because basically I think what happened was you had the likes of Deco and all who were kind of stuck in the past, and they hadn't accepted that punk had moved on to something else. And instead of it being like a lineage where they could have looked at it that way, they just looked at it as this new thing was like fucking gay, and they were real, you know.
What is your view on the beliefs that Hope Promotions held?
Well, I think what Hope did, they did well, you know what I mean? They certainly introduced me a whole way of doing stuff, doing it on your own. And even with regards to just a lot of the literature you'd read at gigs and a lot of fanzines that came out around it, I think sort of inspired me to do stuff, and it opened my eyes to a lot of stuff and gave me a bit of positivity and made me think, oh, I can do this sort of stuff. And so I think it was useful in that way. And then on the other hand, I think some of it was a little bit dogmatic and maybe led to its own downfall. You know, there was a sort of rules, unspoken rules there for a while that you'd only see if you were on the outside. Basically, I think it was a positive thing, far more than a negative thing.
What was your best memory of Hope?
Playing the DIY festival. It was good. It was just playing this big festival with bands like Fat Day and Wat Tyler when I was in the Waltons, and it was like packed out in the City Arts Centre. We played and our singer was drunk or something, and I remember him going out into the crowd and sort of bullying people, pulling people around by the hair and shouting at them, and it was chaos, and it was real good fun. And just a lot of gigs. I played with some real good bands on Hope bills. I remember some of the bands they brought over, like seeing the Sin Eaters play, were astounding. And at that same gig, I got to get up and play drums with Black Belt Jones, and they done a Dag Nasty cover, and the guy from the Sin Eaters got up and sang that. And just loads of seeing some real good bands, being turned on to some real amazing bands that I still listen to today, whether it's like Fugazi or Refused.
You now run Murder City Records. Can you tell me about this?
It's just an independent record shop. It will be based around a lot of the ideas that I sort of picked up on from the punk scene, where you don't really need to work for somewhere else. You can basically, it's a record shop that sells what I'd like to see a record shop sell, which doesn't really exist in Dublin anymore. So we again, it all comes from that sort of punk idea, do it yourself. Myself and my girlfriend decided to run a record shop, and we do. That's it, you know, we got some money and bought some records and got it together, and it's doable, you know what I mean? You can sort of do anything you put your mind to.
Do you feel the Hope book has helped promote veganism in a practical sense?
I never know whether something like that will promote anything. I think if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, you already are, and a book isn't going to make you change your mind. And if you eat meat, a book isn't going to make you change your mind. Because I've been a vegan for years, but when I wasn't, no one going to me be a vegan was going to make me be a vegan. And it's something you come to yourself. But I do think it serves its purpose in that the book is a really good, it's like a history of something that went on, and it's full of all this sort of practical advice. And like, I take recipes out of it and eat them, you know what I mean? So in that way, yeah, it does work as a practical thing. I do actually look at it and cook food from it. And as well, it was just nice to see Noel do that, because it kind of put a full stop on the whole thing, because it fizzled out at the end. You know, the last couple of Hope gigs, that's when I was playing in Estelle, and I was kind of gone, and it was just a couple of people trying to keep it rolling. You could tell that the fire was sort of gone out of the belly by that point, and so yeah, I think I put a nice full stop, and then he was able to have a gig, and a lot of people were there, and we got to play that gig, and like people from Pinscher Martin and other bands, all from the history, who had been doing other things now. It was nice, and I think it ended well. So from that point of view, yeah, I think I put a good end on it. I think it was like a good sort of example of what had happened.
That was a track by Estelle taken from their latest album entitled My Dreams Are Like Rabbits, They Built a Tunnel, Fell Onto the Pavement and Died.
First of all, could you introduce yourself?
My name is Clodagh.
You got involved in the Hope Collective near the end of its existence. Can you tell me about your experiences in it?
Well, Anto asked myself and Jamie, I think, if I remember correctly, to join. So it just kind of consisted of going to meetings. I think they were held on Wednesday nights in Derek and Finbar's flat on Blessing Street. I think he's still there. And we used to all play subs every week that kind of went, just in case there was a shortfall or anything. They all kind of added up. I think it was £1 a week or something we used to put in the kitty. I didn't do a whole lot. I was kind of young and not very confident. I just used to kind of watch what the other people did and go to the gigs and try to muck in. It took me a while to kind of learn about PAs and setting up and that. And loads of times I used to go to the gigs too drunk to help. I was a bit useless at the time. But it was really cool kind of to watch how things came about, how you got in touch with band stuff. This was all in the days before email and stuff. It's mad to think of actually like writing letters to bands in England or Europe, or phone calls corresponding like that before mobiles as well. Well, we're widespread. Yeah, it was a good experience, is a good foundation to kind of see how things were doing.
You were part of the Kids Collective after Hope. What was this about?
It was just a few heads, myself, Stephen Doyle, Damien. There was a guy from Belgium was involved as well. I think Bushy and Sarah were involved for a while as well. Just wanted to keep putting on gigs. Yeah, that went pretty well. It was more kind of like Southern Records, kind of. I remember more indie sounding bands. It wasn't really the heavy stuff that seems more popular these days. Jeez, I can't remember how long that went on, for a year or two or three.
You're now a part of the GZ Collective. Can you tell me about this?
This began in August 2001. I put on a gig for Stephen. Needed some help to put on a touring band while he was out of the country, and I just put it on in the Parnell Mooney. And after the gig, the owner came down and said, if you ever want the venue, you're welcome to it. And by the way, it's free every Thursday night. So it's kind of like, fuck, it's amazing, like, to get a venue handed to you on a plate. And it was free as well. So just my kids, collective colleagues, were all away, that being Stephen and Damo. They were in America. That was pretty much what the kids was at the time. D as well was away. So I got in touch with Jane Ruffino, and she was like totally enthusiastic about it. We put a business plan together and kind of gave it to the owner, and they went from there, called ourselves Ground Zero, then we shortened it to GZ. Then about a year later, we stopped, just because it was really difficult to put on a gig every week and work full time. It's another, whatever other interest we had. And then Damo and Jill started putting on gigs, and Stephen using the name, and that was cool. Like, actually, I'm not really involved much.
Making gigs affordable was one of the main aims of the Hope Collective. Is this still important in the collective you are in now?
Yeah, I do think definitely if you start charging more than €6 for a DIY gig, people tend to get kind of a bit miffed. But I think you have to be realistic as well, and I'm kind of becoming more aware of this recently, like, that losing money is shit, and having to kind of just be fretting over numbers and stuff because you haven't charged enough is shit. Like, I think, like, realistically, what your like hourly wage is and what the price of a pint is and stuff, what you pay for a CD, I think having a gig at for more than €6 shouldn't be such a big fucking deal to people. That like, say, when I was putting on the gigs in the Parnell Mooney, I think we were already charged over €5 even for touring bands and that, and like, just would have made things a lot more comfortable to charge a little bit over. I wouldn't probably go to see a local band for €10 or €15, but I think it's not cool to put yourself in such a position where you're losing money.
Okay, first of all, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Niall, and I'm in a band called The Redneck Manifesto.
How were you involved in the Hope Collective?
I was just on the periphery, to be honest with you. I had known the Hope Collective and the people that were involved in it for a long, long time, because I was in bands and I was playing gigs and I was attending gigs. But I didn't really get involved in putting on gigs too much until I was in a band called Jack Beast, and Hope had been kind of on the back burner for a while because Niall got ill, and it was kind of taken up again, I'd say, maybe a year or two later by Pete Brady. And when he started, it was kind of Pete Brady and Derek Byrne kind of started it up again, with Niall and Miriam helping out. But there was a kind of a more of a collective then, and I was kind of loosely involved with that. It was more to do with supplying equipment for bands. A lot of bands were touring that didn't have gear, so Jack Beast were used as a you know, Jack B. Seth gear, bands are over and they need to borrow gear, they can call on us, type of thing. That was how I was involved mostly. It's just that I had equipment, but I was happy to help out any way I can, because it's such a great thing. I got so much out of the Hope Collective. They just introduced me to so many bands, not only music but books, you know, a kind of way of thinking that I didn't think was possible, or I never even crossed my mind until I'd been to a few Hope gigs, seen the bands, heard what those bands were saying, and was kind of really relating to what they were doing. And kind of going, this is amazing, anyone can do this. Although it's amazing, it seemed really accessible and really just something that could be aimed for, you know, that wasn't beyond kind of, you don't have to be rich, intelligent. It's just common sense, and it's just actually having a bit of get up and go and going, I could do that, and doing it. And I loved it.
What was it like to be part of the first truly independent alternative music movement?
I have no idea, to be honest with you. I never would have even thought of that like that. I wouldn't even like to think about it as something like that. It'll be a little bit kind of slapping each other on the back to go, we were the first, you know what I mean? And I wouldn't even consider myself, like, I didn't start the Hope Collective, but I got on board and supported them as soon as I kind of found out about it, because I think it was an amazing thing. But I don't think that's the point, you know. The first, second, third, it doesn't matter. Once people are doing it, it wouldn't make any, like, if people are starting now, someone that's starting now wouldn't be any less creditable than Hope doing it. And you couldn't say, well, Hope did it first, they're better than you, you know. If somebody started up, like you're saying, like Dylan, 15, putting on all age gigs, that's amazing. More power to the guy. I think he is as creditable as anything that's gone before him. It doesn't matter that he wasn't the first to do it. The fact that he's actually doing it is a great thing. I wouldn't really look at it as being the first or thinking about it in those terms, you know what I mean? I actually don't think that's a positive way to look at it. Just the fact that it was done, you know, and you're showing people that it can be done, and it's bringing people on board all the time. Because people fall out of it. Like, people get involved, they do their thing, they drift away, other people come in, and it's a continuous thing. Like, I'm not involved in it now at all, really. But I have taken what I've learned from it, and I used it all the time. Like, any bands I've been in have booked their own gigs, you know, done their own posters, released their own records, booked their own tours. And I really support that way of doing things. I'm really comfortable with it. I love it, and I love bands that do it. And I love the idea that it can be done.
Has Hope influenced the way in which your band, The Redneck Manifesto, operate?
Most definitely. Like I said, once I discovered that this could be done, once I first discovered Hope, and I realised that anybody could put on a gig and anybody can do these things, it just made everything much, much clearer to me. And all the bands I've been in, I was in Jack Beast, we released our own records, booked their own tour, booked their own gigs, you know what I mean? The band I was in before that, Flexihead, we released our own record. Book your own gigs, do your own posters, do your own promotion as such, you know. The Redneck Manifesto, we recorded and released our own records. You do get help from people, obviously. Obviously, there's people helping you, because, for example, if I was booking a gig in Cork, I don't know where to go, and I would contact someone in Cork, and they would actually book it, you know what I mean? But we would be getting the posters, and you'd be organising things yourself. But they do, like anything, it would have had a huge influence on all of us. Maybe least of all Mervyn, because he's not from Dublin, but he was in a band called Hilton Weir, and their first gig in Dublin was with the Hope promotion. It was down in the Project Arts Centre. Jack Beast played that. That's how I met him. Jack Beast, Hilton Weir, the Waltons, which was Maddie's band, played that gig as far as I know. And I'd say most likely Richie's band, Blank Bell Jones. I'd say all four of those bands played at that gig, and that would have been probably where we first all met Mervyn. I'd met Richie and Maddie before that at Hope gigs. So the Redneck Manifesto got together at Hope gigs. The first Redneck Manifesto gig was a Hope gig. I think it was one of the last ones down in the Funnel Bar. Pete Brady would have put it on. He would have been running Hope at the time. He's gone on to set up Tumped.com. So yeah, they would have been a huge influence.
What did Hope mean to you?
Friends, good music, people you could rely on, people you could trust. That's pretty much it. I didn't give it much thought. I just knew it was the right way to do things, and I didn't kind of look any deeper than that. The people I was meeting at these gigs, I got on with, I saw eye to eye with. I was thinking the same way as them. The bands that were playing at these gigs, for the most part, I really liked the bands. I didn't like every band, but even the bands I didn't like, I could appreciate what they were doing, and I appreciated what a lot of them were saying, even if I didn't really like the music so much. So it just meant, you know, it was just your friends. I mean, they were the people that you hung out with, because they saw things the same as you, listened to the same music as you, and it was just a good thing, you know?
What's the current independent music scene like, and how do you feel Hope affected it?
I don't know, I think it's changed a lot, because there's a lot more bands. Like, when Hope first started, there was no bands really playing here. There was actually probably more venues, more kind of what would have been considered punk rock or alternative friendly venues, like a lot more pubs that were putting on gigs than there is now. But there's a lot more gigs, there would have been very few bands. coming over that I would have been interested in seeing that weren't put on by Hope Promotions. Like a lot of, see, I don't know, a lot of what passes as kind of punk and alternative music, I don't particularly think is. And you'll find it in all sorts of venues with all sorts of promoters putting it on. And it's a lot more hip and a lot more cool to be alternative these days, you know what I mean, or punk. I don't know, I think it's hard to, I tend not to look at scenes or think about it too much. Because it depends, it all depends on your own personal point of view. Like, what's punk to some person is not punk to someone else. What's radical and different and new to some person is not to someone else, you know what I mean? I mean, I would have been listening to, when I was a kid, a lot of kind of metal music, then into kind of punk and hardcore stuff. And then when I discovered Fugazi, I started listening to a lot more melodic stuff. Like, what I had been listening to was like really fast, really intense stuff. And when I discovered a band like Fugazi or something, I thought that music was easily as like intense and impassioned, you know, and as powerful as all this really fast stuff that I was listening to. But it was really melodic as well, and really kind of, not that you couldn't listen to other stuff, but you could listen to it and like really get a lot of stuff out of it.
It's good to see ya.
That track you just heard was by Jackbeast called Scrape 8.
First of all, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name's Dylan. I'm a member of Basta Youth Collective.
You run the Basta Youth Collective. Could you tell me what this is?
It started as a collective of young people who we were all putting on gigs, and it kind of made sense to help each other out, do it together, because it made sense. It was a logical like next step. It wasn't like some plan that we decided we'd do a collective, so it just sort of happened. But we organise gigs, we organise different kind of art sessions, like the Stencils and the City Art Centre, and we've got some other upcoming projects, and we're also trying to put out a compilation of young bands and stuff like that.
Has Hope influenced you?
Yeah, the first thing that made me want to put on gigs was actually reading Niall McGurk's book, a document. That was really the kind of inspiration to say, like, I want to do this myself.
Why do you put on gigs?
The enjoyment of it. Other people weren't doing it, and there were bands that I wanted to see playing, and all ages specifically, so I decided I'd try and put them on myself, and it's good fun, it's not hard.
Do you feel there's more accessibility to put on bands from outside Ireland than there was back in the Hope days?
I definitely, I think so. A lot of the venues we is we don't have to pay costs on venues. It's all ages. We've worked into their kind of artistic program per se. So we're able to put on gigs and events for free. So we're able to give. We've acquired money from gigs now. Even charging like say €3 in, we still build up money. And we're able to give a band a guarantee, so we know whether the gig makes it or not. We can pay them.
You organised a DIY festival in the Project Arts Centre in Temple Bar last summer. Can you tell me about this?
The DIY Fest was the origin. We went to the Project Arts Centre asking to put on a gig, and the guy in the Project Arts Centre said it'll have to be a bit more than a gig. We were like, brilliant, we've wanted to do this for a good while, to do something that was much more than a gig. So we just got a group of people together, and the ideas evolved from there. The festival was just workshops, trying to get kids into DIY. Like, we flyered all the Blast kids to try and show them that they could bother on their own gigs. The idea was not to be forcing stuff onto people, just showing them how they could do stuff themselves. That was the idea behind it.
Did the DIY Festival that Hope did inspire you in any way?
I actually didn't know about the DIY Festival Hope did until after we'd done our one as well. Like, I remember, I obviously had read in the book, but I hadn't gone into my head properly. But so not really now in that respect now.
Thanks to Niall and Miriam McGurk, Andrew Bush, Boz, Clodagh, Niall Byrne, Dylan, Ray Cranley and Vincent Gregan for their technical support. Intro music courtesy of the Redneck Manifesto. Good night, thank you for listening. This is Barry Lennon leaving you with the following track by Fugazi entitled In Defense of Humans.